where, which was also part of D2, is limited in that the state, you know, you got to manage it in accordance with any adjacent land. So if the state has land there and it's, they say they open it up for hunting, nobody can say for sure that the land that is in the land bank is not going to be open to hunting, for public hunting. If they decide to put an access road to the property to, say, a wilderness reserve or something similar to that for recreational purposes or something, there is some concern that if it, the land is in the land bank, there would be nothing the people could say about it because it would be managed in the same fashion as any land adjacent to it. Another problem with that is a 10-year period. You know, the first one is 10 years, and then it goes from increments of 5 after that. And who's to say, you know, and the thing is, you got to have concurrence. You know, the state has to concur with you when you put your land into this land bank. So if the state decides, well, we don't want them to have land banks no more, we want to tax the land, they're just going to say, no, we don't want to have land banks, and that's going to take care of that. What other ones are in there? The right of first refusal is another one that is just merely words. Just simple calculations will tell you if you put even a dollar value on every acre Doyon owns, that's $12 million divided between 9,000 shareholders. We're talking a whole lot of money per share. And none of the corporations are going to ever have that kind of money to buy it out like that. They're not going to have the capital needed to buy the stocks. Another problem is, I think in my whole research of the whole thing, I think the one thing I came about that if there was a crux, if there was one thing in the whole act that needed to be changed, I would say that it would be the right of the dissenting shareholder should be abolished until 1991.
The right of what?
The dissenting shareholder. If a corporation decides to transfer their lands to an IRA or something similar to that, the dissenting shareholder has the right to be cashed out before all that land is, and he could effectively stop it. And that goes to anywhere. I mean, if you go for a board resolution to say that the native corporation has a first right of refusal, the right of the dissenting shareholder comes into play there too. If you transfer your assets to an IRA, the right of the dissenting shareholder comes into play. If you open up your stock, if you open up the roll to allow children born after 1971, again the right of the dissenting shareholder comes into play. That's probably the single most important aspect of the whole thing, I think, needs to be changed. I mean, if you go to Congress with something and say, hey, well, we need this changed, you know, I think that's probably the singular thing they should go to say is just
that's the crux, you say.
Yeah. And ANCSA itself was not, set up, it was done under the guise of self-determination and everything, but I personally feel it was just, an act of assimilation and eventually termination. Corporations in their very essence are not, in their very concept are not able to take into consideration culture and heritage for the simple fact that there ain't no profit in it. It ain't cost effective. And in order to compete in this economy, you gotta manage your resources to the extent that they get the most benefit out of them. And the preservation of a culture and her heritage, you don't get no benefit out of them. It's maybe a moralistic responsibility you may have, and and stuff, but it doesn't do no good to the corporation. It's fairly similar to what Georgianne was saying. You know, corporations are meant to make money, and
What about the right that ANILCA confers on the corporations to exclude non-natives from voting?
That also is you have the right to say, Cheryl, you cannot, if you do that, you dilute the value of the stock. You're coming out and saying, well, once, if I can only sell, you know, or you were talking about non-voting stock, 23% of all the stock that has been inherited already is in non-white hands. That 23% can you're diluting their stock by allowing, you're diluting the value of their stock by saying it's no longer a voting stock, you know, and that's a taking under the Fifth Amendment. You can't do that. There is some speculation too that even if the corporation passed the right of first refusal, that it would diminish the stock severely because, you know, who could you sell to other than the corporation, right? And the market ain't gonna be there amongst the native corporations. Not only has stock been transferred to non-whites through inheritance, or non-native through inheritance, but also the state has attached numerous shares of stock for non-payment of child support. And they're doing it every year now. I think last year they had something like 75 cases, and this year they're up to 150 cases. And these people are getting their stock taken away from them.
And the state wants to sell those on to somebody else?
Well, the state will eventually sell those in 1991 and give the money to whoever deserves it. But I'm thoroughly convinced Congress knew exactly what they were doing when they passed it. They knew that Alaska was going to be needed for exploitation in the near future for the benefit of the country as a whole. And what better way to do it? You know, what better way to exploit a country than to tie it all up in corporations? You know. There's also rumors of lawyers who have taken on native cases for the right to their stock after 1991. Similar things like that, which, you know,
what is the
it's almost too late to do anything about it. I think the right of the standing shareholder has come into play so much that I think if effectively if one person can stop any transaction that a corporation was trying to do in regards to the preservation of anything they're trying to preserve.
Well, thanks, Mike. We've held this hearing on a beach camp that the commission has set up on the Yukon River. Wednesday, July 11th, 1984, and Mike Smith, who has been accompanying us on the trip and who has researched the ANCSA issues and who was formerly engaged in the Lands Department at Doyon, has been good enough to give us his views. Do you have any questions, Carol?
Yeah, I was thinking while you were talking that it might work two ways for the natives, even after 1991, and people could sell. Suppose you had a statute and you had the corporations go along whereby only the only voting rights were those of natives. Now, it seems to me there might be some natives who would not want that to happen. And the reason they wouldn't want it to happen was because they would want to be able to sell their shares, and they wouldn't be able to get as much money for their shares if the buyer were somebody who couldn't vote. I mean, the only outsider who'd want to buy in would be somebody who would want to effectively take over the corporation. So it seems like it kind of cuts two ways. In a way, there'd be, you know, a set of natives who would want to hold on to natives controlling the corporation, but there would be others who were interested in selling who'd want to get the best price for their shares, and the only way they could get that would be to be able to sell voting shares.
The voting shares, I think, I don't think they're going to be able to pass that law anyway, even if they did. If they tried to do that...
You mean pass that resolution?
The corporation can pass that resolution. For the simple reason, like I said previously, was the dissenting shareholder. The dissenting shareholder is going to be able to come and say, hey, I don't want you to do that. Therefore, you got to cash me out, you know. And if you can't cash anybody out until 1991 anyway, that singular person has effectively stopped that, you know. And there are numerous people that will do that, you know.
When they get cash out, what do they get?
They get cash for the value that they get.
How's the value of the share assessed?
Well, as in any corporation, the evaluation of their total assets, which in Doyon's corporation includes 12 million acres of land. Now, you know, like I was saying previously, if you just put a dollar value on that $12 million acres of land per acre, that's $12 million divided amongst 9,000 people, you know.
Yeah.
That comes a pretty hefty sum per individual, you know. Another thing,
$100,000.
You know, that's nothing to you.
I'll have to say another thing.
But on the other hand, too, what was going to really bother me was the fact that in 1991, you know, it's going to tear families apart. You know, you're going to have brother against brother, mother or husband against wife. You know, ones are going to want to sell and the others are not going to want to sell. But then on the other hand, who am I to say that this old fisherman down here who's 80 years old and ain't going to live much longer, who am I to say that, no, he can't sell his stock and maybe make his life a little enjoyable for the rest of his life, you know? You know, it's kind of a paradox. But then on the other hand, you know, who am I going to say that this little girl that's 2 years old here or something is not native, you know, because she doesn't own stock, you know? So it's a complicated situation. The recourse is available, the all the strategies that the corporations are looking at are flawed in major ways, and I don't know if it's my ability to understand what's happening or their inability to understand what's happening. But
by their strategies, do you mean the options that Anilka and the other amendments have made possible?
You know, the majority of the corporations say, well, you know, we got all these things we can do to help protect the land and everything, you know. But I really believe they can't do them. They can't legally, you know, the Fifth Amendment taking of property is pretty well set in the law, in order for Congress or somebody, the corporation, to come and try to change the concept of a Fifth Amendment taking for the benefit of a bunch of natives, I just don't see it happening. I just can't see Congress upheaving all the corporations in the country by allowing something like that to take place. You know, for one thing, the corporations aren't going to go for it. You know, the Ford Motor Corporations and the other people like that aren't going to go for it, you know. Well, they may go for it, but the shareholders aren't going to go for it, you know, across the country. It's a touchy situation for sure. I guess I'm basically more pro-IRA than anything else, or pro-tribal government, in that, you know, I really can't understand why a corporation wouldn't want an IRA government within their territory. If I was on the board of directors of a corporation or something similar to that, I would definitely much rather pay my taxes to a tribal government than to a state government. You know, if nothing else, that's a singular, you know, a singular point that would be very worthwhile to them. You know, why? You know, they're going to pay millions of dollars in taxes to the state, and you know, why pay it to the state when you can pay it to a tribal government, to your own people? They can operate the same fashion they're operating. You don't even have to get rid of Doyon, you know? Just the ownership of Doyon has changed, you know? And they can operate in the free world. They can operate in the U.S. economy effectively. We've seen that on IRAs in the lower 48 to a certain extent, on some of them.
What's the answer then, Mike?
The answer, well, the answer lies within numerous court cases. The vagueness of the laws as it pertain now to Alaska, first of all, will have to be clarified, and that's going to take court cases to clarify the status and everything. After that, we can, you know, once we clarify exactly what an IRA is, what powers they have, or, you know, then we can start worrying about transferring land to an IRA. Then we can start worrying about the court battle that is going to come when the dissenting shareholder says, "No, I do not want my land being transferred to a tribal government."
But you believe that if there are two lines of action open, one based on the amendments to ANCSA that were brought in with ANILCA, and the other based on transferring corporate assets to the IRAs, you think that the latter course is the one to be preferred?
Yeah, simply for the simple reason that IRAs are still, I was talking previously to somebody about this, but Indian law in general is still evolving. To a large extent, I mean, all law is evolving, but Indian law is evolving more drastically and more dramatically than any other aspect of the law. And that's where we might be able to get a little help when we start going to the courts. I don't think we can go to the courts under the pretense of challenging standard business practices and hope to win. We may be able to go to the courts concerning IRA governments and stuff like that and win. I don't think we can take on the business world and beat it in a court of law.
I should say, for purposes of the record, that Carol Rose, a professor of public lands policy at Northwestern University, is accompanying us on this trip, and she earlier asked some questions that are on the tape. Do you have any more questions, Carol?
Yeah, and you know more about this than I do. When the when 1991 comes and the shares are redistributed, isn't that a whole new ball game? Aren't they given out at the value that they are in 1991, and thereafter the owners can organize the corporation as they choose?
Well, it would seem that way. But the owners of the corporation, who are predominantly Native, are going to want to change it in a fashion that the non-Native are not going to want it to change. That's where the battle comes from. By 1991, who knows how many non-Native shareholders are going to be, and who knows how powerful they're going to be. Like I said previously, there are numerous. I know a few lawyers, and I know some of them have taken Indian cases for the sure bet. You know, without the Indian paying a dime, just signing a piece of paper saying he can have his stock in 1991.
But. Mike, doesn't the act say that the shares can't be pledged, assigned, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da?
They do say that, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It happens, you know. It has already happened. The law says a number of things, but we all know how the law works. The corporations were meant. I mean, Congress knew exactly what they were doing. They were meant to be open up to the public. They were meant to be. The lands were meant to be exploited. The resources were meant to be taken out. Congress knew this. I mean, it's just simple logic. Just look at the act itself, and it says right in it, you know, hey, we're going to operate under state. What's interesting about it is that Angsco was the first federal Indian settlement that completely distributed all the benefits to under the control of the state government. You know, it's kind of interesting, you know, in that regard, is, you know, that whole settlement is under state control for the simple reason that it's set up under state corporate law. And you know, the state's looking at us, you know, the state says, hey, we got dwindling resources, but we got Native organizations out here with lots of money, with lots of land. Well, it's just levy property tax, you know. Wouldn't go over very well, but they'll do it if they need the revenue. You know, the corporations just aren't the right vehicle for the preservation of a culture. And our culture is directly situated around the land in which we live, and unfortunately that land has lots of resources and lots of value other than subsistence or livelihood, and it'll be used for those purposes. There's no way the corporation is going to be able to protect themselves. I really can't see it. Granted, there are some corporate strategies emerging now. We've seen the major takeovers of the major corporations, and there's some strategy coming around now that they don't know exactly how it's going to work, but some people are trying it. Some of the major corporations are trying it, pawning off all the assets to a different corporation or something similar to that effect. But then again, you know, I really don't see no way around the dissenting shareholder. There's always going to be that one white guy back there in the background that's going to say, no, I don't want this. I want to be cashed out. I don't want you to change my voting shares to non-voting. I don't want you to issue more shares to children born after 1971. And I don't want you to give the land to an IRA. You know? And if you can't sell your stock till 1991, you know, how can the corporation cash them out?
Let me ask a question.
Under U.S. law, maybe Carol, you or Mike could tell me this. If the buyback provisions were to go into effect and the corporation were to buy back its shares, or buy back shares under the right of first refusal, are those shares then held in the treasury can they be pledged for purposes of bank loans? What's the legal status of those shares that are bought back? Can either of you tell me under U.S. law?
They resort to treasury or corporate stock or treasury stock. You know, that's one of the ploys that the some of the major corporations are using nowadays, is to garner enough stock within the corporation itself to prevent any takeover. Of course, that stock, it's not voting stock after it goes back to the corporation, but it is stock. You know, whether or not they can pledge it or anything, I'm not saying. If I got my concepts correctly, corporations can issue a certain number of stock, and in order to issue any more stock, they have to go through the board of directors and the shareholders and blah blah blah. But if they buy this, it reserves the treasury stock, corporate treasury stock, anyway.
Can you shed any light on that, Carol?
I'm not sure. It's not an area I know very much about. I think it becomes another one of the corporate assets, and if the corporation is going to go to debt rather than equity financing, that's counted with the assets, but I'm not certain about that.
Well, I would like to ask, Mike, wouldn't it be easier if the corporation had the stock within them? Wouldn't that make it an easier takeover target than if the shares were distributed among the shareholders?
Yes, it would. You know, but there's some, you know, I forget exactly how it is. I was reading an article here recently concerning some of the major corporations, you know, the takeovers, the Marietta takeovers and those type things. And I was reading an article on a couple of gentlemen who specialized in taking over corporations, and that's all they did. You know, they just went around and take over corporations for other corporations. And they were saying that there are certain strategies emerging now that may be used to prevent. So you could take the treasury stock and give it to a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporation, you know, or something similar.
I think what Mike was saying is that if the treasury stock is given to a wholly owned subsidiary, the subsidiary then becomes a voter and can vote that block of stocks and can vote in favor of the current directors, and that's to avoid the takeover by another corporation that would boot out the current directors of the corporation.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Mike, just tell us a little bit about your own background and your research into these questions for the record.
Well, I have a wide and varied background. I quit school when I was 16 and you know, lied about my age and went to work on the pipeline and stuff and made lots of money. And took off, went to Hawaii for a while, and that's where I guess I really got interested in land claims, kind of interesting enough. I was working for this old Hawaiian fisherman, and he was involved in their land claims battle. And he was just one of the neatest guys I've ever met in my life. But like I said, he was involved in their land claims battle, and so when I came back to Alaska, Angst had already passed and everything, and I started to go to work for Don Wright, who was consultant for Vinatai Tribal Government at the time, and or still is, and he pushed me toward a better understanding of it, you know, and then I eventually got my GED and went back to college and spent a couple years there learning everything I could about it, and then doing a lot of research on my own, like for Doyon and stuff concerning it. The people that are running our corporations now were basically the same people that were fighting for the land claims back in '71. And however good negotiators they may have thought themselves to be back in 1971, or however good politically they may have been. They were not, however, capable to run a multi-million dollar, in some instances, multinational corporations. But they were given the task nonetheless. And what that instilled in those certain individuals is almost an I'm better than thou attitude. You, the average native, don't know what's going on, therefore, believe me, trust me, I'll make it all okay for you. And it just hasn't happened. My regional corporation may very well be one of the first regionals to go bankrupt. The way our assets have been handled and the way they're presently being handled are just not compatible with making a profit. One of the big problems Native corporations have is that they have a very, very active board. Just about any decision a corporation makes has to go through the board, and which is kind of highly uncommon in the Western world, you know. You usually have a business manager or somebody that makes all those decisions for you. And that's what makes it so hard for anybody to come into a Native corporation and effectively change it to for the betterment. But the boards are very active for a very good reason. And it's that their very heritage that is at stake. And in any decisions they make, they try to take into account for those heritage, for heritage and culture. And it's not cost effective to do it, you know. You know, yeah, corporations in their essence do not have no room for heritage or culture. They are non-racist entities, non-racial entities, and they don't understand, you know. I don't know. It's I almost feel I know it too well because everybody else doesn't know it like I know it, you know, and I feel almost alienated. You know, I have very few people I can talk to, or I know that I can talk to concerning all these aspects and where they all may lead and what choices are available. But the way of the world is that it'll all go to court, and we'll find out in court, you know. And unfortunately, bad case law makes bad law. And a lot of the cases that are coming before courts now are bad cases. Tyonic is an example, you know. I can't think of a worse case to take in front of a federal judge, you know, trying to assert a tribal governmental power. I can't think of a worse way to try to do it than to try to kick a bunch of white people out of the village. Regardless of how good their grounds are for their lawsuits, regardless of the fact that those houses were built with tribal funds for tribal members, and regardless of all that, it's still going to come down to whether or not we can kick these white people out. And I think that's a bad case.
Mike, you said that you were in Hawaii and became interested in their land claims. Any observations to make about their land claims? I gather they don't have any land.
No, they don't have no lands, and the power in Hawaii is such that they will never get I really don't think they may get some monetary. They got an island. They do have an island that is strictly reserved for Native Hawaiians, and it's like a little reserve. You know, you can leave to go to school and stuff, but you got to come back. If you're gone for a certain number of years, they won't let you back in, you know. And so there is some ground over there, but it's very limited. Another problem with with that particular land claims is that there aren't any true Hawaiians. You know, they're either Samoans, Filipinos, Portuguese, or a conglomeration of them. So it's a rather interesting case that I heard of over there was the last queen of Hawaii in the matriarchal system granted a signed a contract with the United States Navy for Pearl Harbor, so that the Navy could use Pearl Harbor for X amount of years. And when that contract was expired, well, the Navy just never did nothing, you know. And there wasn't no strong matriarchal system left then to help to try to fight for it or anything. And so actually U.S. Navy got, you know, some of the primest property in Hawaii for nothing, you know. They just basically stole it.
Carol, have you any more questions about Alaska?
I think I'll pass now.
Okay.
Yeah. This is Jim Sykes. Mike, during the overview hearings, we had a lawyer named Tim Coulter from Washington say that until there is a just and fair settlement, that Native people will always have a cause. Do you think there's any way that that Native people can go to Congress if they decide that the settlement is not fair and just before they go to court?
Well, you could always go to Congress, and if you do your work properly, you can always get laws passed. We see that happen all the time. Political Action Committee PACs do it all the time. But the thing with Natives is that there ain't nobody left in Congress that understands Native law or Native, you know, the problems with you know, Natives. There are very few individuals in Congress with any idea exactly what's going on at all. The present administration has come out in support of tribal governments and stuff, but it's all been lip service. He hasn't done nothing about it. We have a Secretary of the Interior who now tells us, no, there will not be no sovereign nations in the state of Alaska other than the state. We have tax laws that have gone into effect that will effectively stop any other claims that Natives may have in 1986. You hear a lot of talk about going to the United Nations and stuff too in regards to Native rights and stuff in America. Well, the only problem with that is, as is, you know, the problem with the United Nations and the problem with the Organization of North Atlantic Countries or whatever those are, is that they have no enforcement powers. You know, we saw a perfect example of that just recently when the United States told the United Nations, well, you know, forget it, leave if you don't like what we're doing, you know.
In Nicaragua, you mean?
I think that's what it was in regards to. The United Nations was doing something that the United States didn't particularly like, and the United States came right out and said, hey, you know, we don't care. I mean, you know, if you don't like it where you are, you can leave, you know. And that's the kind of attitude we're coming up against now. The complexity of Alaska law, I think, will effectively stop anything from anybody from going to Congress for a change. It'll all have to be done through the courts from now on. I don't think Congress will come back and change the settlement. unless, of course, there is some circumstances where individual IRAs who weren't consulted when it was passed. There is some talk. I don't think it'll go very far in a court, but it is some talk that they took the land without their consent, and that therefore ANCSCA is null and void and blah blah blah.
You mean it was an unconstitutional taking under the Fifth Amendment?
Yeah.
Well,
but in Tehachapi, the Supreme Court of the U.S. decided that unrecognized native title could be taken without due process under the Fifth. Isn't that right?
Well, Congress does have the right to, you know, Congress has the right to make any law they particularly please. Whether or not it's right and just is a matter of personal opinion, I'm sure. Tehachapi said that, but it also said some other things.
Tehachapi is Tehachapi-ton.
Through different interpretations of that particular case and other federal Indian law, you know, that's all it is. You know, is an interpretation of particular case law. And just like opinions, you can have different interpretations, and the only way those interpretations are going to come to a head is in a court of law. The Supreme Court, the present Supreme Court, is not going to allow that, I think. Reagan's gonna put another couple people on that Supreme Court, and it's effectively changed the direction in which the Supreme Court is taking. I just personally feel that the natives are, you know, the natives are just about at their rope's end.
Carol, did you have another? Go ahead.
I mean, you can look at it 100 years down the road from now, or maybe 150 years down the road from now. There ain't going to be no room in the world for cultures anyway. Cultures are dwindling in such a fashion that
you mean indigenous cultures
are dwindling in such a fashion that they'll be absorbed and they'll eventually go to the wayside.
You mean absorbed by the universal culture of the West?
And all we can hope for is to forestall that a little bit, in hopes that we can live our way for maybe the next 100 years, or therefore. A perfect example of the inequity of the legal system in regards to natives is. You know, it's just the simple fact that they treat Alaska differently than they do other natives for some strange, obscure reason that I haven't fully comprehended yet. But, you know, law, especially federal law, would seem to me to encompass all of the federal, you know, all that is the federal, you know, which would be Alaska. I was talking a little bit to somebody about the fractionization of the law in regards to Alaska, and that's exactly what's happened. It's not being applied equally, and it's not being applied equally for very good, you know, for reasons. You know, for reasons. You know, there's reasons behind it. You know, there's the old cliche, there's a reason for their madness. You know, is very true in this particular circumstance. It's estimated that Alaska could provide up to 25% of the U.S.'s demand for oil in the year 2000 or something like that. And You know, that's something that the native is not going to be able to get around. That's something that is far more encompassing than any Indian law may say. As a matter of fact, we are going to have to live with it. But like I said, the best we can do is hope to forestall it. And the way to do that is to be able to control our land, to be able to say who can hunt there, to be able to say who can come on it and stuff. Eventually, we won't have that power no more, but you know, maybe we can have it for a little while anyway. It's kind of...
Here I say, well, shoot, anybody can do it,
dude. Did you have a question, Carol?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something that I think is related to what you were just saying. It sounds to me like what you're saying is, in part, that at least that actually instead of decelerating the decline of Native culture is actually accelerating it because it's a corporate system and that's basically a kind of private property system in which shareholders, some of them are going to want to maximize the value of their shares and the profits in a sort of a Western property way, and others are going to want to maintain the tribal culture, but it's really going to go in the direction of a Western system where everybody's really trying to make the most money out of what they own. If that's the way ANCSA works, what I was wondering is whether you thought there might be some kind of a statutory solution that was political rather than property that would make it easier for tribal groups to organize as native entities that in a way that gave political control without paying as much attention to the property arrangements behind it.
Well, we're talking jurisdictional issue and jurisdiction. Throughout the history of Native law, the states have fought against any jurisdictional basis that natives may get. And it's a logical thing for them to do. In their particular situation, you know, you don't want to give up any of your jurisdiction. And I can understand that if you're a state. Politically speaking, I don't think there is a way. ANCSA was passed for the sheer reason that there was oil that needed to be got out. For the simple reason that, I mean, we fought ANCSA for years and years. I mean, I think it was, there must have been, you know, 15 or 20 bills formed. None of them went anywhere. But as soon as the oil companies came in and said, hey, we need the settlement passed, you know, ANCSA was passed in a year, you know. Politics act on, you know, politics in general, by their very nature, have to take into account the masses, and the masses are not natives. The masses are non-natives who have no idea, you know. ANCSA was interesting in that, you know, I was trying to think of a parallel on how, you know, I could explain ANCSA, and all I could think of was it was taking a white person from the middle of New York City and dropping them out in the wilds of Alaska and saying, here, make it on your own now. And it's obvious what the outcome of that particular situation would be. And it's, I mean, it's true. Just all you gotta do is just look at the bare basics of what ANCSA was and what it did. And you can just look at that it was meant to fail. There was no way that we could change our whole outlook on life, our whole outlook of our heritage and everything in a mere 20 years. It's just not possible. That's just not possible. Well, no, and that's the other thing is we don't want to change, you know. But they forced it upon us. They're forcing us to adapt, certain Western society notions in order to survive. They're changing us. They're assimilating us. There is no longer no self-determination. It's strictly assimilation. Assimilate us into the Western business world, and will eventually go away. That article I was reading here a little while ago about the two gentlemen that take over corporations, I fully believe those guys could take over any corporation in the state of Alaska in just a matter of weeks, probably, and that would be it. People say that no, they won't sell their shares in 1991 and stuff like that. But I think they probably will, for the simple reason that they haven't ever seen nothing from it. And this is a quick, easy way to see something from it, something tangible. You know, it's nice to say, well, we got all this acreage out here. What really got me was my village corporation. Georgie Ann mentioned this the other day. I went down to the village the other day, and I had to get permission from my village corporation to go cut firewood.
What corporation is that?
Ghana-U, which is a conglomeration of four village corporations, Caltech, Nulato, Kaikuk, and Galena. And I had to go, you know, get permission to go cut firewood. And
We had a hearing at Galena, and Pat Sweetser, the land manager or vice president for lands of Ghana-U, said there had been a lot of complaints about the requirement that there be permission to cut firewood in corporate land. But he said the idea was to set up in place a regime relating to land management so that they could insist on that regime and no stricter one being enforced when the land went into the land bank. It was a kind of precautionary measure to prevent state or federal government insisting on a harsher land management regime when they put their land into the land bank. Anyway, I think in fairness, I just should mention that.
That's fine and dandy, but what they're in fact doing is setting up the, you're making a real strong corporation. And if that corporation becomes so strong that, they're making a strong corporation, which is fine if you're a non-native corporation. But once you tell a bunch of Indians who got this land claims, you know, who thought at the time, hey, I'm gonna be able to go cut my firewood and you put, you know, on our corporate lands and stuff. And you start telling them you can't do it, you know. What you're in fact saying is we're sticking by this corporation. We're gonna stick with this corporation and we're gonna try to make it work. And I just don't think they're gonna be able to do it. If they wanted to, they could have done the exact same thing with the tribal government and just set up a land use thing. The Navajos recently have done that in regards to hunting and fishing. They have come out and said, the Supreme Court the Navajos had a case against the state of Arizona in regards to hunting and fishing regulation on the reservation, which is now an IRA. And the Supreme Court has come out and said, yeah, it's fine. The Navajos have had a comprehensive fish and game management scheme. They've had it for years. They've been managing it just fine. Therefore, we don't need the state. I think that's probably what Pat was trying to say, is that he's going to set up a structure so that when somebody comes along, we can say, hey, we've been doing this. Well, that's fine if you're an IRA tribal government. But it ain't so good if you're a corporation. Regardless of what they do on land use policy within a corporation, they're still a corporation. And there's still, there's the stronger the corporation, the more tempting it looks to be taken over. You know, those are the corporations that will be taken over first. You know, and the village corporations will be the ones that will be taken over first. It's another thing that Angster did was to fraction the land from the village corporation, between the village corporation and the regional corporation. Now, if that wasn't an obvious ploy to split the native group into, you know, split the natives and split any possibility of them being able to control their land, you know, that it was completely obvious to me anyway. I can't see no other reason for it. You know, why give the subsurface rights to the regional corporations? I don't understand why they did that. Nobody's been able to give me a good concrete answer to that question. Other than that the regional corporations were bigger, had more money, therefore, if they wanted to, they could go exploit the minerals.
They had the capital.
Had the capital behind them, yes. But that, you know, that ain't a, you know, that's an answer, but it ain't a very complete one. The village corporations could very well have done the same thing. They didn't need the capital on hand to extract their resources. The capital would have came around if the demand was there. You know.
You mean that if you have the resources, you'll get the financing.
If you have what they want, they'll be glad to pay you to get it. You know. You know, so it wasn't. I can't justify that particular action for those particular reasons. The regional corporations have signed agreements with certain, you know, village corporations have been manipulated by the regional corporations into signing agreements which they call land selection maximization agreement or something like that, to that effect. And what they in fact did was to get the village corporations to select certain tracts of land, therefore, you know, making it a larger square area of land. But the village corporations now have selected lands that are no good for them. You know, they're good for, maybe they're good for exploration, which is a perfect example of Stevens, or up here above the bridge, is what they did there. You know, Doyon did there. You know, it's good ground for oil exploration, and that's what they're doing with it, you know. But it's worthless ground for subsistence uses or what have you. Some of the villages had picked land along the river, you know, where they live, which I would have done. But no, the regional corporation came in and said, no, let's pick this land that's 30 or 40 miles off the river, and, you know, therefore we'll get a bigger hunk of property, you know, under the pretenses that we'll get a bigger hunk of property. You know, never mind the fact that it's no good for you, you know, but it'll do us good, you know. You know, so, I don't know. It's just... It's almost, yeah, I don't know.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike. Thanks very much.
I saw it first. I did. I was taking a pee up there, and I looked down at the creek.
Big, 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 big,
hungry, he'll stay there chewing that fish for a little bit.
He looked hungry, man. You see the way
that one time we across the mountain, that white guy, that albino bear came out. I was about to turn to me.
What was he saying?
I had big bear. You see the fat rolling right off. At first I climbed the smoke house and sit on the car.
What's it for? Let's just see. The bird's on this side of the cushion. Right, Tom? Huh? That rock where the bird's on this side of the cushion?
Yeah, it came out right there. And right down the mountain.
I'm coming around the hood of the sand.
There's this one, though. God, you're close up to the bird again.
They
didn't kill us down there.
Thank you.